Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptor Podcast. I'm Josh Beitzer, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smokey Games, Kenneth Ong.
Hey there.
And our returning guest is fan of the site, Evan Hitchings.
Hello.
All right, and hopefully you guys don't notice too much. Not only did the headset have some trouble, so I'm back using my old webcam, but I also have a bit of a cold this week, so I'm going to sound a little bit more off than normal.
Yay, double whammy.
Woo!
All right, so we got a lot of news to talk about this week, and my piece for today is an article that just went up today from Tripwire Interactive. These are the guys who did Red Orchestra 2, Killing Floor, and I think they've done a few other games, so those are probably the two most that people are most familiar with. So the creator of Tripwire, the president, John Gibson, he was doing an interview with PC Gamer about the state of first-person shooters, and he talked about how great that single-player first-person shooters have gone. They become less on rail, more open, but then he talked about how multiplayer, in his opinion, has degraded thanks to Call of Duty.
Thanks,
and in the article, he basically talked about how Call of Duty has, I guess, in a sense, has dumbed down a lot of what made older first-person shooters better. Like how fast the game is, how it's about these constant rewards, less about actually playing the game. Now, I think that's an interesting point. On one hand, I think he does have some positive aspects about that, in the sense that Call of Duty, when I played it, it is a bit on the simplistic side. Every time I've played Call of Duty during, like, the free multiplayers, I could only play for maybe, like, 2-3 matches at a time before it just got so boring. But on the flip side about it, he talked about how much, you know, he felt Red Orchestra 2 didn't get a fair shake. I played that game, and I really just couldn't stand it. It was... have either of you played Red Orchestra 2, by the way?
Is it one of those, like, realistic shooters where you die, like, with one hit?
Yeah, it's super... It's, like, very super realistic World War II-based shooter. It's one of those games where, you know, any shot to your from your chest up is pretty much a kill shot. And you get shot on the arms or leg, you have, like, 5 seconds to patch yourself up or you'll bleed to death.
Yeah, that's,
brutal.
Yeah, that sounds like the games I always stayed away from, like Rainbow Six and... there was this realistic... What other realistic ones really popular?
Rainbow Six. SWAT. There's the SWAT series.
Yeah, there's another military one that's very famous, but I can't remember it.
Soldier of Fortune?
Yeah.
SOCOM?
Was that similar to that?
Oh, yeah, SOCOM. Yeah. Although that was third person, but whatever.
Yeah. And so with Red Orchestra 2, it's also like one of those games that when I played it, like the wide open maps are really sniper-friendly. Like you could just be walking around and boom, dead. And you have no idea where it came from, who shot you, so then you respawn, boom, shot, dead, again.
Yeah, that sounds like Arma 2.
Yeah, something like that. Or Operation Flashpoint, super realistic.
Jeez, I hate that. Because I've even played Arma 2 on single-player mode, and that happened to me also. I'm like, ugh, I would have enough as a multiplayer. Why do I need it in single-player also? But then again, I guess if they're emulating, you know...
Like
war.
Realism.
That's exactly what happens, yeah.
Yeah.
So, what do you guys think about that? Do you think that first-person shooters have been dumbed down in a sense over this last generation?
I think there's room for everything. I mean, there's still communities for some Unreal games, or, like, there's new versions of Quake that are out now for guys who want that sort of, like, old-school hard. And then there's still communities for games like Arma and Operation Flashpoint and for Red Orchestra that want that hyper-realistic game. I think first-person shooters are just, you know, everyone wants to talk about them now because it was the defining genre of this, you know, past console generation. You have suddenly all these people playing realistic pseudo-realistic shooter, like arcade style, like Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's because of Call of Duty that they don't want to play those games. I mean, I get that, like, there's just guys that are going to play Call of Duty. We're a bunch of guys who don't play Call of Duty. We still don't want to play Red Orchestra.
Well,
yeah, that's true.
I think what's happening is that it's like follow the leader, right? Because if they have such a successful formula, people want to follow the same thing. And I guess that's what I think he's talking about, is that kind of corrupting force in a way. That, you know, everyone adheres to that structure. then, you know, creativity is lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, to a degree, there's always been games like that, mm-hmm. and there's always been, you know, defining game series of any particular subgenre. You know, you can point to Doom clones, and there was a million of those, but then you would find ones that came out and did something to differentiate themselves, like Duke Nukem.
I think he's talking about, like, a majority. So, same thing goes with single player. Like, he's talking about, well, single player FPS games eventually got more open. Call of Duty called it back to set pieces and, like, linear corridors, et cetera, et cetera. And that
And
that is now, like, more of the norm. So when we started to evolve, now we started to devolve because of that. So he's talking about the dangers of that and how it's becoming more apparent because that makes money and, you know, it's easier to control an experience if it's linear.
Yeah. Now, one part of the article where they're discussing a little bit of sort of the mechanics behind the two games. One of the quotes was about how the skill gap in games like Call of Duty has been compressed because it's all about the metagame, about, you know, every time you get enough kills, you get a kill streak or you upgrade your gun. And that is a far cry from the old days when we talk about games like Quake and Unreal, where there was any metagame. The only way you were going to get better at these games was the fact that you would improve your own skills. You weren't going to unlock, you know, rocket launcher +2 that gives you, you know, 10 more damage. And I think he does have a fair point in this regard that metagame content has somewhat downplayed player skill in some sense, but on the flip side, I think metagame content has done a lot for giving these games a lot more longevity compared to older titles. I know that both of you enjoy Team Fortress 2, and one of, like, the best parts of that game has been their whole metagame system. And that has done a huge amount to make that game very replayable.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I love TF2 is, again, to me it's a game of adaptation. You change your loadout to what the scenario is. You change your class based on what you need. If you see a whole team that has, like, 40 snipers, you don't go sniper. You know, you pick a class that's useful. And, again, talking about skill versus this unlock system, MLG is going more that direction. They want to produce a game that's focused on skill alone instead of having these unlocks. Because, again, it is unfair for someone to come into a game while everyone's, like, crazy leveled and you're, like, level one. It's like, you're already at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
And the thing in multiplayer design, you want everything to always be fair and even.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's crucial. That's why I don't really like, modern console shooters. I mean, first things first, like, you know, if they're popular on consoles, playing on a console with a controller already compresses the skill gap because, things like twitch aiming with a sniper rifle or something like that, you know, is a lot more pronounced on PC and a lot more effective with a mouse and keyboard rather than playing with a controller. But then, you know, I do absolutely hate these unlocks that just because you played longer, you get to start with significantly better weapons. Now, granted, like, you know, in a lot of games, you aren't completely locked out, but I remember watching my roommate play Far Cry 2 online, and it would be like for 15 minutes before a match start, like a match making lobby would be filled up, but people would just start to stack on one side based on like what level everybody was, and then it would just completely dominate the guys who only had like two guns.
Right, and I think that this whole unlock system too kind of came from the gun mods and like Counter-Strike. Like that whole unlocking based on how many you kill. Like I find that actually one of my favorite of the old mods is like you kill somebody, you unlock the next gun, you have to kill someone it always end up with there's always this really bad pistol, like the 70, I forget the exact name of it. It was like a bunch of numbers. Two numbers.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
It's like impossible to kill anybody, but if you pass that, it was very rewarding.
Yeah. That one's like, I think it has like really good long range, so that's what actually makes it good.
Yeah, but you to kill somebody, there's up in your face, so like have fun missing.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, those sort of like RPG systems are designed to make the game itself more addictive for multiplayer and to give people the feeling that they're actually making progress, wherein, you know, a game more balanced around skill, you would only be making progress if you're actually spending some time practicing it. So they give you this sort of illusion, and that sort of Skinner box effect is what makes it so addictive, just as like it's fun to play gun game for like hours upon hours, stretch that over to, you know, an entire, like, Call of Duty account, and as you play more, you automatically unlock more guns, so you're doing better, even if you're not actually any better in the game.
Well, I think another reason it's trending is not just because it's an effective way to create, dedicated players is that they can also exploit the system to get money off of people with microtransactions and XP, like, you know, like the selling up, buy Mountain Dew, get XP, like that kind of thing.
Double XP weekends and all that.
Tying real world products with, you know,
the whole like Mountain Dew Doritos thing for Halo 4 is insane last year.
That was a big controversy that year. So again, and the gamers don't like knowing they're being exploited.
Like that Gamer Grub products and bullshit like that.
Oh, I just on a side note, I really hate gamer themed products. They always anger me. Like those HD gamer glasses. I'm like, dude, what HD gamer glasses? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I know, right? Is that gonna up the resolution of my eyes?
Yeah, is it like covered in grease and sadness?
To be clear though, if it would help my eyes when staring at the screen for long periods of time, I would buy those.
But
as long as the marketing wasn't too obnoxious.
It's just like really cheap plastic for like $100. And then you can...
Yeah, I got better things to spend $100 on.
Like 100 glasses. All right, go ahead.
Now, with the Oracle, in the past, I've talked several times about the balance act between player skill versus player time, or skill versus, you know, the free-to-play concept, or pay-to-win. And it is an interesting point that we're seeing more and more these days, as you were talking about, Ken, that Call of Duty has become, you know, the banner, the poster child that other developers are copying. And we're seeing more titles being developed with microtransactions. But one thing I don't like is, I think I like a good balance. If it goes too far on either end, I find that I don't enjoy the game as much. Like going back to Red Rooster 2, which is completely skill-based, it just got to the point that the game was just frustrating to play. But then on the flip side of that, when I tried playing PlanetSide 2, which is predominantly microtransaction-based, it's all about this grinding for new weapons, perks, add-ons, that just frustrated the hell out of me when I get the drop on a guy, and because, you know, he spent an extra few hours playing the game, he wiped the floor with me and there was nothing I could do about it.
Listen, they really want you to buy things, because in that game, to actually unlock the weapon would take years to get the next sniper rifle. I just dropped some cash because it had station cash on my account. So I just dropped it for a sniper rifle that was adequate. I feel like that the level, the numbers they chose were pretty incredible in terms of how to reach it. So it would probably take you like a week of just grinding. And that's not worth my time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then again, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to exhaust you by getting slaughtered continuously to buy the weapon you need.
And it's the same thing we see in a lot of mobile and social games, where they basically make playing the game without spending money so frustrating, so boring, that you have, you know, they make it so it's like no other choice but to spend money or suffer.
Yeah.
I think, again, when you go into free-to-play model, there's a certain level of expectations of how much you're willing to pay, or like understanding that microtrans will be in the game. But again, it's all about tasteful design, right? It's kind of like when, let's talk about like web design for one minute here. In web design, if you go to a site covered in advertisements, just banners everywhere, floating all over your mouse and cursor, what's the first thing you want to do? You want to get the hell out of there. And, you know, the thing is that the sites that actually are effective is when you have ads that are built into the style or structure of the site itself. Something that doesn't seem exploitive, but part of how you read. So goal as a designers is to kind of find that happy medium of the two. But if you're only there for exploitation, all you're going to do is just destroy your audience or lose your viewership or etc. And same goes with these free-to-play games. You have to be very careful with how you try to make your money. You can't just say how much are they willing to take, Zynga style. You know, you try to have feedback from your audience and cut back when you need to.
Well, I'll say this about free to play. Like, I really think that the best format is just, you know, nothing that actually affects gameplay needs to be bought. You know, and like, you shouldn't have to really grind for anything that's going to affect the gameplay. You should have more or less an even field. TF2 gets it, but nobody gets to say TF2 in this argument anymore, because people just get angry and say that TF2 is the exception. But I think just doing cosmetic items can work. And if you don't think it would work for your game, then your game probably isn't aesthetically pleasing enough. If your game doesn't have a strong aesthetic style, then why am I going to care about customizing my character? If you make a game that looks cool, that, you know, has somebody that I can say, okay, yeah, what can I do to personalize this guy and make him mine? if you can do that, then you can support your game with just cosmetic games alone. I used to play wrestling games just because I could customize a guy, and I don't watch wrestling. I haven't watched wrestling in, you know, like 20 years, but customization can mean that much. And if you were to release a wrestling game on Steam with, you know, Steam's Workshop support, where anybody could like make stuff and they put it in the game, they split it just like TF2, I guarantee you that game would make enough money to support itself.
Look, that's what Path of Exile does, and that's it. But to me, that's just a really well-balanced game with a great art style. It's very reminiscent of Diablo 2. And they only sell cosmetic items there. I find that very refreshing.
Yeah. Like, one of the things that holds me back from wanting to play LoL is I know I'd have to unlock, like, runes, and I'd have to unlock characters. And I know I could buy some of them, and it'd be cheaper than the, you know, major cost of, than the cost of, you know, like, buying an entire game if I was just going to play with, a couple characters. But, like, I'm used to getting fighting games, and some of them have, like, 52 characters, and I sit down and I play as everyone and I get an idea of what they do, and the idea that I would have to pay or wait for certain weeks to do that, like, just drives me insane.
Yeah. Again, that is more like, do you want to waste your time, or do you want to just spend some money and save your time? It's like holding your playtime ransom. It's pretty much what they're doing.
Now, I remember a quote by one of Valve's designers for Team Fortress 2. This was right, I think, around the time that they started introducing the in-game store. And he talked about they found that to motivate people to either buy or play a game or, you know, get more items, they had to attach some kind of value, either in the form of time. You know, when you play X amount of minutes in Team Fortress 2, I believe they give you a free item. Is that right?
More or less.
Yeah, they said that, or to attach a monetary value to it. But either way, in order to make the item have some kind of meaning, there had to be some kind of value. And I thought that was very interesting, because Team Fortress 2 has been really good in balancing that out. You can play the game, and you get a decent amount of items just through play. But there's always that attraction, you know, just spend, you know, a few bucks here or a few bucks there, you know, to get a new hat or to complete your set.
Yeah,
I think it's even
just unlocking crates.
I think the unlocking crates is probably the most money-making thing they got. You just want to buy keys. It's like it's something interesting about knowing that you get something in this box. You don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But it's just like gambling. You never know. You know, you roll the dice, see what happens. I mean, you know it's probably going to be bad, but you still want that chance. Same thing with these crates.
Yeah. It's a literal Skinner box is really what it is.
Yeah. I mean.
And they don't. I mean, let's just call it what it is. I imagine they make some money off of those engagement rings.
I still see those alerts. They just
I turned off all alerts, but like I still end up seeing like people taking pictures of them, of you know like just the guys who just spent $100 for like a funny name.
Yeah, I really hate that. I see it. It just distracts me entirely. I'm like, great.
Yeah, I turned off alerts for that. But yeah, I think cosmetic items alone. I mean, in 2D fighting games that I played, you know, I would actually buy unlocks for different character colors. Just because they looked cool or extra costumes, like I would totally do that because everyone's got their favorite costume that they always play and they always represent in any fighting game. And fighting games, you know, are generally very aesthetically pleasing. You know, so if your game doesn't have a really good sense of style, then you're not going to be able to support it, and that's why you turn to terrible, terrible microtransaction systems.
Yeah, because you made all this investment in time and development, and then you're not getting your money back. So, because again, like a big thing is turnoff, like. One thing about games is impression, right? So if you come into a game, it looks god-awful terrible, but you know the gameplay is great, you know, or you hear that the gameplay is great, sometimes that awful design choices and look is just too much to handle. You just can't. So, I mean, that sounds like a very ambiguous answer, but you just get that feeling where it's like there's other games that have like a greater level of engagement and an aesthetic that matches the engagement.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to the next piece. Ken, what news do you have for us?
All right, well, let's go with SimCity Part 2. Usually...
just keeps getting worse.
Well, usually companies, you know, get a handle on it by this time. Like, Diablo 3, by this time, they already stabilized all their servers, and everything was more or less peachy, or hunky-dory. But SimCity, they just keep putting their foots in their mouth continuously, you know? First they came out and said, like, SimCity, you know, it has to be, it's integral, it has to be online, there's no way around it, impossible. But just recently, just today, modders were able to remove the online or force disconnects, and they were able to play the game offline forever. So,
wow, an improved product.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. So it was pretty much a lie, so.
Yeah, and I remember them saying that there were certain... I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's also been reports that people have found faults in the glass block simulation model, that the system doesn't actually portray the cities realistically after it gets to a certain number of population. I think under 50,000, the game will basically track each citizen and, you know, simulate their actions. But then when it gets above that, they start using like a different equation that alters that. And they've also found issues with, like, the traffic system. I think someone, like, broke the whole traffic system. Like, the other day, they did, like, a video of it.
Is it the people walking in circles?
Yeah.
Well, that and, like, basically, like, nothing's actually a sim. Like, you couldn't follow, like, an individual guy at all. It's just, like, people, like, go to jobs, and they just walk until they find an open job, and then they walk in there. And then when the day's over, they walk to whatever the first house they find that has been taken by somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like, everything's just, you know, like, big. The best description I heard was, like, marbles rolling around and just filling whatever holes are available in, like, a board.
So pretty much, you know, they was all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, and the smoke and mirrors are very apparent. Like, I mean, I'll say, like, as the Grand Theft Auto games progressed, their smoke and mirrors got harder to see. So apparently SimCity's going the opposite direction.
Yeah, and you know, I think people should check out Chris Beatrice's article on Of Walkers and Men, City Building by Design. It's on the website. It's a guest post. It's really cool. It's one of our first big guest posts, and he has a great talk about the push and pull system.
Yeah, and for those of you who haven't read that yet, Chris Beatrice is the current head of Tilted Mill, who are made up of the developers who did the Impression City Builders during the 90s. That's Pharaoh, Zeus, and they've also did, I think, Caesar.
Children of the Nile?
And Children of the Nile is with Tilted Mill, so that's what they did after they formed a new company. And, of course, they're currently working on Medieval Mayor, which is their first city builder that they've made since... I believe it was a Caesar sequel that they did during Tilted Mill.
If only they released it right now, they'd be making mad cash.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen, like, the jabs all the companies have been making at EA? Like, I think Good Old Games did, like, a Twitter that they said, our SimCity game doesn't have Always On, you can play it right now.
Nice.
Or I think the Hotline Miami guy said, our game, Hotline Miami, always has Cheetah Speed on. You don't need to worry about slowing our game down.
Oh man,
these guys are great.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't think anyone defends EA except for Maxis, obviously, but they're trying to, I think in terms of PR, they're trying to separate Maxis the developer and EA. And Maxis said, like, in an article recently saying, hey, or just like, at least a shout out that's saying that EA does not control our design decisions. But the thing is,
The
thing is, EA and Maxis are the same company. They've been the same company. There hasn't been an independent Maxis in 8 years. They're far gone. They are EA. There is no distinction between the two. They're trying to make that illusion. But make no mistake, it was EA's choice. And this is what they wanted. The end.
And you can definitely see just how much of a difference in quality there is. When did Will Wright leave Maxis, by the way? I'm not quite sure. I know he was there from The Sims.
Well, didn't he leave after Spore? Did he leave after Spore? Was that it?
Possibly, because I remember he did do interviews for Spore. I think that was the last time I heard from him.
Yeah. Sometime after Spore, I'm sure. And that was...
That game was a terrible
letdown. That was a letdown, too.
Yeah.
Bunch of lies on that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as bad as, like, Peter Molyneux, but still bad.
And that had internet issues as well. Yeah,
that definitely. It was one of the first always online I hate DRM thing. So.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? So, I mean, obviously we can probably put a stake in SimCity. It's probably done. But you know what the next SimCity should have? Something like Steam Workshop. You know? If you're connected to the online server, You can get complete mods and reskins that people make for SimCity.
Don't say it. Because it's going to be, they're going to do it for Origin, and it's going to cost money to, like, register, to do workshop for the...
Okay, so somebody just needs to build, like, a fan-made SimCity that allows for people to make and sell their own stuff, a la TF2 items, and you get half the credits or whatever, just like TF2, because, you know, like, some modders out there is going to, you know, get a license to some licensed product and make sci-fi themed ones, and you wouldn't need a medieval civil... city builder.
Well, medieval mayor should be the one to do it. There we go. That's how they're the mad cash. They're like, where everything SimCity was and wasn't. So here we go.
I would pay good money for somebody to get the rights and make a Futurama mod for a city builder.
Well, this is,
like, all of my money.
No, I'm sure that the guys at Tilted Mill will eventually make something like that. Because I have a lot of faith in their products, and the guy is, like, so smart, so... I'm really excited to see Medieval Mayor and what they're going to actually release.
So, with last week, there was problems with SimCity because of the always-on, they know of the play. This week, we had the whole catastrophe with the simulation failing. So, what do you guys think is going to happen next week?
Well, I guess one thing they talked about is Amazon is now taking returns or refunds for SimCity because it doesn't work. But... Their policy itself is, like, always about returning, but they specifically said SimCity, so there you go. So it looks like there's going to be some backlash, because I could just see, like, you know, EA's board be like, well, they already bought it pre-orders, who cares, we made our money. And that's what they're going to say.
Yeah.
But when they start seeing the money...
Isn't that what destroyed the comic industry?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, sales only, you know, the publisher only cares about sales to the store, not about sales to the public.
Yeah, exactly. And they're in that disillusion. The thing is that if people are allowing refunds for SimCity, they're starting to start to lose that money that they, quote, made. And don't forget, they obliterated the franchise. No one wants another SimCity. And no one trusts EA developing a SimCity. So, in, like, of the little goodwill they had, it is now completely negative. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's... people thought EA was evil then, they're going to see them evil now. But this is, again, this is specifically just for gamers out there. Like, the general populace doesn't know SimCity that well or care. But, again, who's the audience for SimCity? Like, PC gamers. Yeah. So they're going to be raging. So...
Yeah.
I don't think you get...
As a really good bit of irony... Tilted Mill actually made the last SimCity game.
SimCity Societies, right?
Yeah.
I heard that one was decent, but I don't know.
It's gotten mixed views. From what I've talked with fans and a few people who worked on it about, they did have a lot of things forced on them by EA. Like, they didn't want to name it SimCity Societies because it was such a complete difference from the past SimCity games. They just want to call it something else. But EA said, no, we want, you know, the SimCity brand attached to it. And when the game was first released, I remember hearing there were a lot of bugs, lots of issues, and I think they did somewhat turn it around through patches and the expansion pack. But, yeah, it's definitely a bit funny how EA, you know, did a lot of harm with Societies, and now they did a lot of harm with this SimCity.
I just think they don't get it. Maybe, I don't think it's vindictive, I just think it's ignorance, part of it. With that, with SimCity Societies, the reason they did that is because they wanted to put an established IP. It's a lot harder to market something that's new than something that's already known, you know, it's a household name.
Yeah.
Similar to that whole Dinosaur Planet Star Fox thing, you know, Star Fox Adventures. The reason it ever became Star Fox Adventures is because, you know, who knows Dinosaur Planet? No one. So attaching it to that would guarantee some sales. Same for SimCity Societies.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end of the day, I always blame marketers for all problems for games. They're just like, well, we need to get this out some. I mean, it is true, marketing is really important, but they shouldn't be controlling design decisions. That's what angers me. When they're like, all right, the only way to market is if it has to be always online. And we need to put social everything in it. Like, no. That's the wrong direction, I would say. Some of their ideas are pretty cool about what they want to do with the online stuff, but when you run into this kind of problem, and then you run into all these lies and bad PR, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
It was a single player experience. So when you force this on to players, this is not what they're expecting. It's not what they want either. So Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's for games that have to have always online. If you're going to have a single player option, I think single player and multiplayer should be somewhat separate to keep both sides happy. When you start combining it, you then run into these issues where neither side is happy.
Well, the thing is that it costs a lot to create both, right? If you could just mm-hmm. make one mode, that would benefit you and cut your costs in general, right? So mm-hmm. you can keep selling it for $60 and have a lower budget, right? That's good for EA. But to make both single and multiplayer, I mean, it could have been very easy for them to separate that. Like, that's one of the same games that could easily do that. But they just decided not to. That's the erroneous part of it. It, like, programmatically, I could see it making it a lot easier. Actually, all those, like, fake simulation stuff that's happening after certain numbers probably wouldn't be an issue with regular PC, like single player, without separate requests and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And just that whole, and you guys, just so you don't know what cheetah mode is when you can speed things up really fast in a Sims game. Taking that out is like an integral part of the game. Like, you need cheetah speed. You want it to see progress.
Yeah.
So taking that out is you're again, like I said last week, cutting off your nose inside your face. It starts to dismantle your game, pretty much.
Yeah. And I think the worst part about all this is going back to last week is that it's fair to say that a lot of the issues with SimCity 5 were known by EA. Issues with the server capacity, the falsity of the simulation aspect, and it just seems like they really didn't care. They wanted to get, you know, the first 2 weeks of sales and, you know, to screw it at that point.
I mean, it's like I always say, they have to answer to investors. They have to release certain things within quarters. This is why it happened. I don't think part of it was we just need to get out the door, and the other part of it is investors. So that's pretty much it, I would say. It's just all that pressure, which is why, you know, people love, you know, just straight up independent developers. And that's why everyone's like, if they don't need to use publishers, great. Because they know what publishers do to IPs. Rarely do they approve of it. Except for, you know what's really interesting? This is a more side note thing, but Square Enix have done awful with their own IPs recently. But they did great with the Eidos IPs. It's like,
yeah, it's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's they maybe it's because they're so far away, they just fund them and they don't have any control.
Yeah. They just find good Westerners to make good games while they drive their series into the ground.
Yeah, I mean, like, listen, I mean, Deus Ex Human Revolution, I loved it. Obviously, the worst mistake was obviously farming out the boss battles to a third-party developer, another developer. And Tomb Raider looks excellent. The Let's Plays that I'm watching, I'm like, I really just want to buy it. But I have BioShock Infinite, so I have to balance out my play. So,
did we ever think that we'd be saying that, like, as a community? The new Tomb Raider looks excellent. Like, I thought we were past those times.
It looks really awesome because it has all the
it has
the free running. It has some great. I mean, I heard like people said like there's a disconnect between what's happening in the scenes and like the level up system with your weapons and stuff. But it still looks like the combat is fun. And the thing is, you want to have fun. You don't want Laura to like continuously miss with her bow, like straight up like Oblivion style or Elder Scrolls style.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Yeah, so. You know, she has to be able to, like, power these men, but she's not, it's not like a power fantasy. She's not like, oh, I'm the greatest, and like, just standing over their bodies. She's doing it because she has to do it. You know, these people are attacking, even when she's yelling at them, like, what do you want? Stop doing this. Like, then she has to make her mark, so. And, again, like, she seems more fleshed out. I heard that there were some issues with the characters, but I was watching Let's Plays, and the characters seemed pretty developed to me, and she has more of, it has a very interesting drive. There's a lot of mystery to the island, which I love. I love the concept of that mystery. That's what's engaging me to want to watch more or to actually buy the game.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm just saying.
Well, it's a far cry from Angel of Darkness.
I have not played that game. What was it? Was it that awful?
Yeah. Oh, it was terrible. You could just be, like, walking along a ceiling, and then it would just, you would just fall through it. I don't mean, like, it was a trap that was unfair. I mean, you would just fall, just flip through the ceiling.
Yeah. I mean, those were the age where you had to build your own game engines and stuff, instead of using third parties and stuff. The only problem with, and this is, again, a side note, is when you use third-party software, like, a lot of developers, when they don't have, like, a specific style, a lot of the games tend to eventually look the same, you know? Like, a lot of Unreal 3 developed games tend to endlessly look the same, their characters and everything. Style doesn't
shine through. Yeah, like, it's possible to build Mirror's Edge, and, I mean, they could put TF2 on the Unreal 3 engine, and you could make a game on Unreal 3 that would look like that, but most people just kind of go with the stock set of textures and colors and all that, right. And all the games end up looking very bland and very samey.
Yeah, so many of those. That Turok reboot was so awful. Just going back to that. Does anyone remember Turok?
I do, for the
64. Yeah, they made a reboot for the 360, I think, and the PS3 probably. It was like the most generic thing you could possibly imagine. It was awful. And again,
I remember Zero Punctuation's review of it wasn't even a full review. There's like, there's not enough to talk about specifically in this game. It's a show bland and generic. So we're going to talk about all these bland and generic shooters that have cropped up.
Yeah, exactly. So they just add them all together. But that's it. I mean, it's people, companies, big companies see that FPSs are the way to go, and that's why they produce all those games in the mid-2000s. So.
Seriously. How do you screw up dinosaurs? How?
Well,
it's impossible.
You make the character as bland and boring as possible, I think.
It's dinosaurs!
Well, you don't want to show them. You just want to make them... Well, I think, to me, it's like the Colonial Marines of that time. Colonial Marines is still pretty awful, by the way. That's another one of those things, but nothing compares to what SimCity was or has become. Going back to SimCity,
it's not so a sim, and with it all crashing all the time, it's not really city.
Yeah, it's more like EA's bad decision, the game. They should retitle it that.
All right, what news do you have for us this week, Evan?
No, I mean, I was just all on the SimCity, watching that train wreck all week. Oh, it was the worst thing ever.
I mean, maybe we should go on with the games you played this week.
All right. I have two. I've been somewhat getting back into strategy games this week. I've been playing the Banner Saga Factions, which, for those of you who haven't seen yet, I put up our interview with Stoic Games yesterday. And for, like, the first time in a few years, I played some StarCraft II the other day.
Is it because the expansion came out?
Yes, and the fact that I keep hearing from people that they updated the UI, they've made it less hardcore gamer-friendly. Like, they now have, you can see how many workers you need on mineral fields, or you can now just set your unit rally points to units. It makes it just a little bit easier.
That's good.
It's better, but it's funny. I just don't find myself a huge fan of StarCraft 2. I'm just not into like that kind of like Twitch mindset when I play strategy.
Yeah, were you a big fan of the first one?
I played the story, but the same thing. I tried like a few matches online, just got utterly killed, and I just never went back.
Yeah, it's just one of those refined taste kind of things, I guess.
Yeah, well, like, back... You know, I had a period of time where I was pretty good at like playing on micro maps because I had bad internet that would cut out every 30 minutes, so that's all I had time to play. But like, I did all right with that. But I haven't even like picked up StarCraft II, you know, Wings of Liberty or whatever yet, just because I don't have time to play that enough that I'll be good enough to be happy with myself. Like I can't pick it up and then just be bad at it. I have to be somewhat competent.
Right.
And I don't have time for that.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those, again, instead of refined, I meant acquired taste, like that kind of game, and what it's turned into. But I still, I heard from a friend of mine that, you know, the single player is really cool, so I'm interested in getting it one day if it ever goes on sale.
Yeah.
That's going to be one long
time. I know, it's similar to EA, you know, they don't put their IPs on sale either.
Wait another 9 months, then they'll have, like, the battle chest of Heart of the Swarm and Wings of Liberty together.
All right, I'll give it a shot, so...
Wings of the Swarm, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that last week I was talking to a friend. He was asking me about why I'm so good at Left 4 Dead, which is another game that is somewhat on the Twitch side. You need to have these first-person shooter skills to play that game well.
Right.
And even though I'm so good at that... I just can't get my, I guess, can't wrap my head around playing StarCraft 2, you know, super fast, APM, micro craziness.
That's something...
Uber micro!
That's like completely different, I think. Like, there's a lot more complexity when it comes to...
Yeah.
I mean, there's complexity to like Left 4 Dead Versus, no doubt about it, but there's a different level of like complexity and mindset for playing StarCraft 2, or StarCraft in general. And as for Left 4 Dead 2, by the way, I always told people that you were really good because you had a special headset, which you didn't. I'm like, whoa. So, good on you then. You just had a very good ears, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're both Twitch games, but I mean, you know, they are like completely different sort of skill sets. I mean, it's the same way that like fighting games are Twitch games in their own way.
Yeah.
But again, it's a completely different sort of skill set.
Watching it's kind of fun, but jumping into it, you're just going to get slaughtered if you're not practiced.
Yeah.
Like, I love, like, I don't know, you don't like Skullgirls, but I love the art style. I love the music. I love the, like,
no, I just don't like the first three characters they showed off with the crazy hats. Like, I still haven't played the game. I feel terrible, and I really should.
There's some awesome characters in it. It has,
yeah.
I just love everything about that. That's a style that I enjoy. And it's also, you know, set in, like, the Roaring Twenties, which I love. It's my favorite era.
Yeah, that soundtrack is amazing.
Yeah. So, that's a great game. But again, it's hard to get into if you had, like, no practice. If you just jumped into it on an online game, you would just get your face tossed to you, you know? So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
One thing also about StarCraft 2 is that, unlike StarCraft 1, the single player and the multiplayer are completely divorced from each other.
Yeah.
In single player, you get access to units and tech research that you will never see playing online. And on one hand, I think that's good that it gives single player its own flavor. But on the other hand, it basically makes all the time you spend playing single player pretty much useless, because when you try to play multiplayer, everything that you learn from the single player just doesn't apply. Outside of, you know, learning, you know, hand positioning and APM and stuff like that.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I don't know that I necessarily mind that. Like, back in the day for StarCraft, I always just, you know, played the first third of a campaign and said, all right, I know enough about how to play this game. I'll figure out all the other units and, you know, just random melee matches. But, you know, the first game was kind of like that, in that sometimes you would get, like, sort of special units. You know, you'd get that one that you had to protect, like having Kerrigan on the map, or, you know, the first time you got one of the Vulture Cycles, and then eventually they became a standard unit. But, I know, like, the single-player StarCraft has, StarCraft 2, like, you know, you have access to fire bats, which they took out for multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say it's completely wasted. You are still building up those skills, like you said. But I mean, you know, if you can tell a more dynamic story and, you know, have the gameplay be more interesting going through and have access to different units in your single player scenario, I think that's pretty good and makes the overall experience better, even if some of those things couldn't be included in multiplayer for balance reasons.
Right.
Although I'd put money on that some of the stuff that's in the first single player one will eventually get added in multiplayer.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean, in StarCraft 1, medics were going to be in the base game, but then they were held back with Brood War.
Well, I mean, plus, hey, less development time, too, to put it in. So, instead of creating something brand new, they use a unit that wasn't unlocked before.
Yeah, just go ahead and tweak it, you know, add some more lines and some more animations.
Change the color, call something else.
One thing that I found fun, I got a little chuckle out last night, was I loaded StarCraft 2 up, and I saw a world that says, you can buy Heart of the Swarm right now and just, like, add to your account that way. And I just found that so funny growing up during the time where if you wanted a Blizzard game, you had to pre-order that thing, you know, at least 4 or 5 months in advance, or it would be sold out.
Well, it's the future, man. Digital distribution. That's why it's awesome. You know, you don't have the limitation, the heavy cost of print. We did some research recently that of how much a book would cost to actually print out. Just a small amount is up to $30,000 just for like a couple hundred page book. That's freaking insane. But if you did it on an ebook format, it's only like the, you know, the online core, like, cost of like hosting the file. That's it.
Which is next to nothing.
Yeah, it's like a few $100 at best for several years. So people like flippantly throw away like print stuff and books and stuff like that. I'm like, dude, that costs like $30,000 plus. I'm just throwing away. But again, the only thing that people, the reason that it hasn't taken everything by storm and everyone would think it was 100% to eBooks is because of piracy. Like, that's something that they have to handle themselves. And it's like what everyone, but with programs and stuff in games, it's easier to combat piracy than it is to, you know, protect a file format. So.
Yeah.
Now, moving on the other game, the Banner Saga, I found that very interesting. Now, for those of you who haven't read the interview yet, the Banner Saga Factions is the free-to-play, I wouldn't say like size, or just the free-to-play edition of the actual Banner Saga full game, which the actual game's going to be a massive single-player campaign.
When's it coming out, by the way?
From what they said, they're shooting for sometime late this year at the moment.
All right.
And with factions, it's basically just the combat system of, you know, separate from everything else. And it's a very interesting system. It's all turn-based. The heart of the system is with your units. You have, I believe it's 6 units, 6 against 6. And you can customize units. Like, if you get 5 kills with a regular unit, you can then promote that unit to one of 3 different classes. And each class has different stats, and they have a different ability. And the whole ranking system is attributed to that. Basically, it ranks you based on how strong your units are, not what your win-loss rating is. Or it does that a little bit, but it's predominantly based on your units. Mm. And one of the things the designer said in the interview was he's heard people describe their system as pay to lose, because what they found was a lot of people would spend, you know, $20-$30, get, you know, the best units, and then they would get ranked up against someone who's, you know, played 500 matches and just utterly decimate the guy.
Wow, that's an interesting matchup system. How did they address wow. that?
No, the guy who had the matches won because he had more skill, not the guy who spent more money.
No, I understand that, but what did the interviewer say?
He said that they preferred that, which part? You mean the fact that it has some microtransactions or the ranking system?
How the microtransaction interacts with the ranking system.
He talked about how that they prefer that way I'm just looking at the interview itself. Because part of the complaint was the fact that the game had microtransactions. Because as we all know, it was a Kickstarter campaign that succeeded. So a lot of people weren't surprised by that.
Yeah, they succeeded, not just succeeded, they succeeded way past their goal. So they made a very large profit. But while you're looking that up, I'm just going to say, like, the Banner Saga itself, the art style is one of the best I've seen, not just in an independent game, but in any game in general, using a 2D art style. It is a very...
Yeah, I was kind of impressed.
It's really fluid. It has a great sense of its own identity. It's just... Every aspect of it is very well designed, so I applaud the art director.
Mm-hmm. And he actually talked about the inspiration for the style in the post as well, if you haven't read it yet. And so, what he was talking about, the reason why they include microtransactions was that basically they're used to support the cost of keeping factions online, you know, paying for server or for development. And he argued that basically it was either this or that for other free-to-play games that don't have any kind of pay barrier or any kind of way of bringing money, these games are usually just, they're dead after a few months because they don't have the funds to keep supporting them.
Right, and he's going for longevity, but I think the only reason there was outrage to begin with was because, you know, they funded a single-player game, they got multiplayer in it, but they did declare it in their stretch goals, so I don't really see the problem with that. And then it doesn't take anything away, because they already had to build the system, they're just adding more components to it.
Yeah. And in the interview, basically they're using all the data they're getting from the multiplayer to play test and fine tune the combat mechanics for when they release a single player game.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to do, to make sure that they have a more of a streamlined,
all right,
not streamlined,
so,
but a more fluid experience.
Evan, have you been playing any games this week?
Play the single player game.
I haven't been playing anything new. I got an opportunity to teach a friend of mine a couple of board games, B-17, an old Avalon Hill game, and Memoir 44 by Days of Wonder.
Okay.
And I taught her a whole bunch of like fighting games, so that was pretty cool. But nothing new. Beyond that, I've just been playing, you know, in my UGC team for TF2.
Oh.
All right.
As for me, I have been playing Dreamfall. So that is the sequel to Longest Journey. And the reason I played through it was because the Dreamfall Kickstarter just ended. Ta-da! And they made like $2.5 million. So they asked originally for $850. They got $2.5 million. And they actually reached their goal almost within the first day. So that's really awesome. Because I'm finished playing Dreamfall, and my god, that game goes off with so many cliffhangers, so many unanswered elements, that I'm really chomping at the bits for this Dreamfall chapter is to come out, which is coming out November 2014. Mm-hmm. And I think that they did a great job with their campaign. They were really connected with the audience. And just saying, I think the worst part of Dreamfall itself was it being attached to the Xbox. Just because they had their controls for an adventure game was all attached to the controller. So like it was really awkward camera. It just felt like there was like messages from the Xbox era attached to the game in terms of how the camera worked and how the characters moved.
Oh wow.
So that's like the only takeaway that was really bad. I still think the voice acting was really good and the story itself was pretty intriguing, but I didn't feel like it wrapped up with enough answers. It only left more things unanswered. So I think that's another reason why, other than people loving Longest Journey as it was voted the most popular adventure game in 1999, but I think people followed it to Dreamfall and they were just waiting for the third one to come out. And there's so much rumors about the third one because it got funded by the government. But then again, as I said the other week, it got funded by the government of their government in Norway through a grant. And then they used that to prototype for Kickstarter. And then again, it turned out really well. And again, I'm very excited. So there you go. That's my game of the week.
Now, during like the last week, Ken kept using me for moral advice for how much money he should pledge towards it. So what was the final total you pledged?
75. Originally, it was only like 15. Mm-hmm. So, and eventually, they kept offering new tiers. I'm like, oh my god, if I spend $200, I get a 16 gigabyte monkey USB. I'm like, but why would I do? Why should I do that? It's like extra $100 for like this fancy USB stick that will only be sold via Kickstarter. Now I regret my decision.
Every time you saw someone, I got a message, Josh, should I pledge $1,000? Josh, should I pledge $1,500? But they let you be a character in the game.
I'm like, Josh, but call out my name from the town crier. I need to. It sounds awesome. I should do it. Or like, Josh, I could spend $10,000 and go to the launch party. What do you think?
I think I said, sure, go for it. I think that's when I said, okay, you have my blessing for that.
That's a pretty high cover charge.
Well, I think I'd only do it if they gave me like room and board and they pay for my plane ticket. Then yeah, I'll do it. It'll be quite an experience, but also an enormous waste of money.
We do get all the extras, though.
I also get 10 copies of the game. So, but then again, I don't know 10 people that have played Longest Journey all the way through Dreamfall, so mm-hmm. It would be kind of like, I'll just give myself 10 copies for fun. Yay!
But, I don't ever finish Longest Journey either.
By the way, again, I went back to play that game. Voice acting is still excellent. Characters are still excellent. All of it is really well done. Again, my first true female character that wasn't like sexified. It was just a very, just a person in an environment living their life. Mm-hmm. It was a very strong personality. It wasn't, it wasn't exploitive. And again, it didn't follow the whole tropes versus women thing, which that video just came out by Anita, whatever her name is.
Oh my god.
I can't pronounce that last name. I'm not even going to try.
Anita, blah, 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 blah. She finally released through her Kickstarter the $250,000 video, Tropes Against Women, where she pretty much spent an hour railing on Nintendo.
It was just part one. So I think it was like 26 minutes of part one. I don't know how much part two is going to be, but I think it should be, I guess it's coming out this week. I don't know what her actual schedule is.
Well, I think what she should do is, obviously, I feel like the flaw in the first video was she raised awareness but didn't really make any sort of statement that was, life-changing or something or advice. You know, it's all negative, no positive.
Yeah, it's easy to tear something down. It's a lot harder to build something up.
Yeah,
you know,
you need to offer solutions, right? Yeah, it's like when you're giving, when you give a critique, like especially within the field of art, when you're making a critique of a piece of work, you just don't say, I like it or I hate it. You need to give a reason of why and a solution of how to make things better. It's like, I hate it for this reason, but here's an alternative that solution that could work based on these requirements. You know, it's the same thing goes with that. And for her, she just pointed out, like, here's an observation. Here's another observation. Nintendo, why do you keep doing this? I'm like, okay.
Now, I think she was incorrect about Star Fox, we talked about earlier. Uh-huh. The reason why Fox was the main character wasn't to appeal to the male demographic. It was a brand decision that the Star Fox brand was a lot stronger than the Dinosaur Planet brand.
Exactly. And again, they came out with a really lackluster game because they pushed those two things together.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't the first time Nintendo made a misstep like that. I mean, they made
screw up dinosaurs? Again.
Yeah.
Please, guys, they're dinosaurs. They're awesome. How do you screw this up?
Well, Nintendo messed up again with Other M. They should have never made that game.
Oh,
that
was terrible. What a
giant leap backwards for all females in games.
Did she bring up the Other M in her argument? Because
No. I think that's next. I think that's part two, I hope.
Here's something. Every mainstream game critic criticized it for that, so I don't think we need a woman to do a Kickstarter to point out how bad it is when everybody has already said it.
Yeah, and the only thing she did between the Kickstarter and the video she just released was go to a TED talk about how everyone bullied her. And I think that everyone should have a right, free speech, right, and the ability to say whatever they want, an observation. I think you also need to, with that money, you should be really clear of how you're going to use it. She didn't need to do it, but the right thing would have been like breaking down the cost of what she's going to do with the money.
I mean, all things considered, you know, anonymous 15-year-old dudes are pretty harsh to women online, but and, you know, so I'm sure that she was bullied, but at the same time,
yeah, she probably was crazy bullied, for sure.
But at the same time, she was doing a Kickstarter for the video series that anybody else puts out there for free.
Right. And, I mean, again, she did only ask for 6,000 and got 250,000 in return.
That's awesome.
But I think the reason people put so much faith in her, put so much money into the Kickstarter is because she was going to offer, you know, real-world solutions, not just observations.
Yeah, well, let's see how it pans out. Let's see if she has, you know, real-world solution that's any better than what we said for free on our podcast last week.
Yeah, as I said before, last week, the best way to make a female character is to just create a strong personality, a person in an environment, a person reacting to their environment, you know? Not covered in exposition, just someone that feels real based on their own interaction. And then it doesn't matter what gender they are, because as soon as you put a gender on there, you know, all the consequence of putting a gender to a character is then all the weight of that gender will then be placed upon them automatically. But you don't need to beat someone over the head with it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the problem with a lot of developers. They have to be like, I'm the heroine, and I'm a girl! Like, you don't need to do that. It's already...
Bayonetta.
It's already, exactly. And a lot of people like to play on the old exploitations of the 70s, like how all those films were about exploitation of either being a gender or being a race. They're trying to do that in games to be trendy, or like a lot of directors use movies as reference, and then they lose fact that games are an interactive medium. You know, you don't have those kind of limitations of just being forced to watch cutscenes all the time.
Yeah.
That's what Other M did, by the way. Just cutscene mania. No control.
And I think one thing about the trope she was talking about with the Princess in Peril, there's also the argument, is it really a trope, or was it in the past basically a narrative device? The hero, you know, having to, you know, prove his worth to save, you know, the woman he loves.
Yeah.
Damsel in Distress, right?
Yeah, it's no different than Star Wars, right? I mean, but, you know, in the end, Star Wars, Princess Leia ends up being pretty good. And I'll say, you know, Princess Peach was pretty good in Mario 2, and she's pretty good in Smash Brothers.
And she's also pretty good in Princess Peach, the DS game.
Yeah, except that game, like, crying was a superpower for her. So I feel that we can't exactly hold that one up as, like, the paragon of a strong female character.
not a strong one, but a fun game, though. But anyways, I would say...
Well done.
Well, they what she was talking about, like, example, like she said Zelda was never a main character in a game. That's untrue, because she was the main character in two CDI games. Bam.
Bam.
But
the argument right there.
Right there. She's like, well, then again, she, in her video, she said that Zelda was, every time Zelda would transform from one character to another, like Sheik, when she transformed into back into the princess to get kidnapped within like 5 seconds. And when in Wind Waker, when she became, when she was a pirate, and then she became, you know, the princess again, she became inept at doing anything. She just stayed in the castle.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she brought up some interesting points, but again, Miyamoto doesn't design around narrative. He designs around fun gameplay. That was always his goal. So, that's not what's going on. And she wasn't trying to exploit women. It was just a device. It could have been anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a narrative tool. At the same time, like, I think, you know, her sort of attitude, it's the same sort of attitude that brought people to say that, like, Spelunky was sexist because, you know, you're picking up random damsels in distress. But ultimately, you know, that's almost like a, you know, a throwback to the old Mario games. It's, you know, it's used, you know, almost for nostalgia, you know, winking, you know, at video games, you know, lampshading a trope sort of purposes rather than actually being sexist. But I think a lot of people, you know, had the same sort of attitude that she did and, you know, got all on that developer about that.
Mm-hmm. She did have a good point, though, about Double Dragon. I think that...
Yeah.
That definite thing was a little too far to when they did it back in the day.
What a favorite... What a famous scene. Come up, punch a girl in stomach, take her.
Yeah.
Sometimes with or without panty shot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Japan.
Yeah, but, like, at this, by the same token, like... You know, I don't think we're going to be looking to, you know, a game like Double Dragon, you know, an action game where, like, two dudes run around and punch people. I don't think we're going to be looking at that for, you know, well-developed, well-rounded characters of either gender, of any type. That'd be like looking at a movie like The Expendables or something and expecting, you know, really well-rounded, deep, complex characters with lots of issues. It's not that sort of... You know, genre. Right.
She would probably argue that by ignoring that, you're ignoring the problem. But then again, I would say, like, when you create art, you should have free range of anything. Any sort of message you want to convey shouldn't be limited, even if it's bad. It should be there, you know? Sure, if you just want to, like, a mindless action flick, then sure, why not? It doesn't have to be deep. It doesn't have to tell, a crazy exposition and backstory of, you know, the history of Denmark. It has to be, you know, it can be about a bunch of dudes shooting up, like, nameless foes. Like, that's how some games are made, too. They're like, we have a really fun mechanic, let's just design something around it. That's how a lot of game developers make their games.
Yeah.
Not every game is going to be the next Portal
or Journey.
Or the next Mario. I mean, some games are made explicitly for a single purpose, either to have a fun game mechanic, like Katamari Damacy.
You know, I would say the 90s was the age of game exploitation for women and genders and stuff like that. Like, that was, like, their marketing campaign was so... There was one commercial where it said, save the girl or play like a girl or something like that, and I'm like, whoa. Nice. Like, I think their marketing team was way sexist.
Well,
more sexist than the...
All of the marketing was aimed at, like, 10-year-old boys at the time. Yeah. So, you know, like, the Sega Game Gear advertising itself is, like, the only thing cooler than farting.
Yeah, what?
Oh, that's real. That happened.
They should have
RPG colors. We had, you know, the muscular man sitting next to the woman wearing a chainmail bikini.
Yes. Yeah. Well, good old tropes. Yeah. But that was the age. I feel like we've come a little more sophisticated, a little more aware. But we're also very sensitive. You know, and it sounds really girly to say that, but they are. I mean, the reason why these people, like, backlashed and went crazy over Nia's video, because they felt they were being attacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? Like, it's kind of like, you know, the whole, like, when these people are like, reverse racism, like, blah, 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 like, that's just a BS argument.
Yeah.
You're allowing reverse racism to be racist. That's what you do.
Yep.
And same thing goes with, you know, anti-sexist or whatever, eventually makes you misogynistic. So it's all about, like, balance and moderation. Look at yourself in like, another perspective, you know? I'm not saying you have to be, like, crying and weepy, but you shouldn't, you know, you should also be wary that, you know, there's people behind just the concept of a gender. You know, there's a person behind that, you know, that sex, you know? There's more to a woman than just her gender.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that people have to understand. But not every game has to be like that. Sometimes games can be made just to be fun.
Not every game needs to, you know, deal with complex issues like Persona 4 did. You know, I don't think we're going to be looking for every AAA game to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we don't want a bunch of Duke Nukems either. We don't want a bunch of Duke Nukem Forevers. We don't. That would be like if you know, that was the degradation, you know? If we had an apocalyptic future for games, every game would be Duke Nukem forever.
Or Turok.
Yeah.
Or Turok. Turok would be, like, the high-end art game.
That's purgatory.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, wait. I got it. It'll be Turok, Duke Nukem Forever, and Final Fantasy 14.
Oh, my God. 14. 14 itself is purgatory. If only we could preserve that on a server and play the original as it was released. I would have loved that. The torture. I mean, anyone would just question their lives. Like, am I really alive? Or am I... I'm in some sort of torture space. But
and for those of you who have listened to that, I know we talked about doing a podcast specifically on women in the game industry, and we're still planning on doing that. I think we should be doing that in the coming weeks. I have to, of course, get my headset back and, you know, get well from this little sickness I have.
Yeah, and I think we'll have a very good discussion. As I said the other week, people always use just, like, this is the way it is, as a way to get around arguments. Sex sells, all that stuff like that. They say that because that's the way society is. But that's stupid, because that shuts down, like, real discussion.
Yeah.
And our goal for that cast, again, from like I said last week, is to broaden everyone's mindset and just tread the grounds that make people uncomfortable. Forget the real reason of why and how we can, and then really offer a solution and see, hey, if our solution matches up with, you know, Anita's solution. So, so just a call out for anyone listening right now, if you're interested in coming to cast to talk about this subject, just by all means, send us a mail. Just go to the contact form. There's a submission button on the sidebar, which also allows you to go to the contact form. So please send us a message if you're interested in talking about, you know, girls, women in the industry, or even if you're a guy, if you want to talk about your viewpoints, or if you've worked on a game, etc., about the betrayal of females in games. So
yeah,
by all means, send a message.
All right. So let's put that aside for now and move on to the post for this week. And the post we're going to be talking about, I think this is my record for, like, most, you know, artsy titling I've had for a blog post for Gamelism, the contemporariness of game design. And that was not easy to say when you have stuffed nose and sick, by the way.
I still can't say it. I'm perfectly fine. At least I think it is. I am. So,
the subject of the post is on the concept of basically games outliving the time that they were created, or the concept of timelessness. We see this in other mediums, art. There are, you know, classic films, you know, Godfather, Casablanca, and even with TV series. There are a lot of TV series that I like. I still love watching the original Looney Tunes from the Golden Age of Animation, or the Twilight Zone. I still think Twilight Zone holds up today in terms of its storytelling.
Definitely.
Yes and no.
Well, to me, Twilight Zone was just, you know, different questions about the human condition, you know, different scenarios, hypothetical situations.
Yeah.
I think that's how it stands up.
Mm-hmm. And it was, and for those who, if you ever watch, like, the DVDs, they have, like, the making of or a little bit of history, the Twilight Zone was created during the time where a lot of TV was censored. It was, you know, most TV shows were controlled by, you know, commercials or the corporation. They, you know, wanted, you know, squeaky clean TV, or they wanted to prioritize advertisements.
Go ahead.
In that time, like, to give you some perspective, when Star Trek was first being cast, they were going to have a female first officer, and the company, the producer said, okay, we can't do that. No one's going to respect a woman in that sort of position. And furthermore, that guy with the pointy ears, get rid of him, because he's going to remind people of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
Yeah, so the fact that the Twilight Zone did as much as it did is just astounding. But I think like you talked about in your post how some games don't stack up today because, you know, the interface isn't there, and, you know, some things that we take for granted now, you know, like those games don't have those sort of features, and they don't, you know, really work outside of, you know, playing it for nostalgia's sake.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true across any medium, because, like in your example of the Twilight Zone, they got away with a lot, and you can look at a lot of storytelling about the human condition. But at the same time, there's some episodes of the Twilight Zone that just seem completely generic because the stories have been redone, parodied a million different times, or the tropes that they introduced are just so commonplace that you don't realize that you're seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, It is definitely hard to go back to the Twilight Zone because, as you said, a lot of the stuff, a lot of, you know, the big twists of the Twilight Zone have been, you know, played out so many times across regular TV shows or just at the
same because
time.
they use it as a reference, you know, to make their own.
Yeah, it's the same thing for, like, Citizen Kane. Like, if you go back and watch Citizen Kane and you don't know anything about, like, where the film was in history, it seems like an utterly generic film, and you wouldn't understand why it's considered the best. But then when you find out that, like, virtually every filmmaking technique that we use to make films today was, you know, premiered or was first used best in that film, you can appreciate it more. But if you just go into it blind, it seems, like, utterly bland and generic. Just like if you were to jump into, you know, a game that maybe doesn't have as many features as we're used to now, you know, you may not realize that you're seeing the implementation of certain systems that we have now.
Yeah. Citizen Kane still has some things that are very unique or very daring about them, because he was pretty much, you know, making a statement about a very, like, famous, powerful media mogul who, if you cross his path, you would be dead. And he kind of killed his career. He did get blacklisted. And he was never at the same level. He could have risen to another potential, but he took on the big dogs from his first big film. And it's similar to nowadays if someone were to go and smack talk Rupert Murdoch.
Now, one part of the post, as we talk about how a lot of these games were, you know, the foundation for what we have today. Now, I assume that the three of us, we've been playing video games for a while now. Is that right? Last year. But as we talk about, a lot of these older games, if you look at good old games' entire catalog of games, you know, from 93 and before, a lot of that stuff, even though it's rated highly, is also incredibly dated. I mean, I showed someone with Ken last week about King of Dragon Pass, which is considered by maybe like one of the most innovative and finest games released. But, I mean, you take, like, 10 seconds and look at that UI with those screenshots, it's just very off-putting, and it is hard to go back to that time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of games where I'm like, I really love this game. And, again, this whole nostalgia gloss comes on. I'm like, oh, well, maybe I was wrong.
You spend 10 minutes fighting with the interface, and you give up.
Yeah, like, how did I put up with this, you know? And there are, like, I think I always find myself really foolish when I think about how awesome graphics were back and then, like, oh man, this graphic on the Sega Saturn is so cutting edge. And I'm like, oh man, they're just cutting me now.
Yeah, like 3D graphics are the worst because they age terribly. Oh, yeah. So, you know, for example, I can tell that Half-Life 1 is a great game, but every time I go to play it, I get to the part where I get outside and I kind of lose interest. And,
yeah, but should
you know, that's why, like, Black Mesa is so big, because it's updating bad 3D graphics.
Well, you know what? Like, games that do handle up is games with a lot of style to them. Like Beautiful Joe or...
Yeah, you need good aesthetics.
Like Jet Set Radio, it's still excellent to this day.
Yeah, it looks great. Team Fortress 2 is cel-shaded for that exact reason. Like, you know, it holds up better. Even Habbo Hotel went with a 2D art style because it would age better. And they wouldn't have to replace their graphics.
They still stands up. I can see it in my head. It looks fine. You know? It still looks great. I think there's something very special about 2D art, you know?
Yeah. Good 2D animation, I think, holds up real well. I say the same thing about Looney Tunes, with how great that hand-drawn look was, and the same for when we talk about the Banner Saga. That is a very unique and stylized look to it, because of
beautiful.
That they went with
that. It feels like they had like a whole team of animators working on it, but it's just a few guys, and that's, to me, very impressive.
All right, so I think that's going to do it for the podcast. I would like to thank Ken and Evan for being on.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me here.
And we definitely will have to have that podcast with survival horror games.
Oh, and
the
women's
tropes
one, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And as always, we'll end it with, if you would like to write for our site or be a future guest on the podcast, feel free to send us an email.